possible to bring to a better degree, if you will, the jobs or the labor and the business community together? It seems to me that there's a little thinking out there that everybody has to be adversarial and that we can't work together. And so that's why, one of the reasons, again, I say why we set this up and to see how we can work more closely together, the labor community and the business community. And I know Dick Anfang and Larry Dahl, Dick Anfang from the Minnesota Labor Movement and Larry Dahl, president of the Chamber of Commerce in St. Paul. I've noticed a wonderful working relationship with these two over the years, so we thought we'd invite them in. And at that, why don't you come to the front? And maybe you can share with the community what your two groups have been doing collectively together over the years, and give this committee maybe an example or two of how things can get done and how you worked together on the XL and some other projects and housing, I know, guys. And so why don't you just, with that, introduce yourselves and talk to us a little bit about how we can all get along.
Thank you, Chairman Metzen, members of the committee. I'm Larry Dowell. I'm the president with the St. Paul Area Chamber of Commerce. We represent approximately 2,200 businesses, primarily in the East Metro area. Our primary service area is about 12 communities in the East Metro area, and we're the largest local regional chamber in the state of Minnesota. And our business base is primarily small business. Approximately 90% of our companies are classified as small business in the more narrow definition of 200 and less employees. We're an active participant in the policymaking process from the state level, a little bit on the federal level, but also on the local level where we spend the most of our time. We advocate for a healthy business climate, not only for our region, but for the entire state.
Mr. Anfang.
Thank you, Senator. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Dick Anfang. I'm currently the president of the Minnesota State Building and Construction Trades Council. I served for 15 years as the president of the St. Paul Building and Construction Trades Council, hence my long relationship with the St. Paul Council. In our St. Paul Council, we have about 14,000 members, all in the building and construction trades, and therefore we're very, very on the cutting edge of what's coming up in our community in terms of construction and jobs and economic development. We many years ago felt that if we're going to be interested in economic development, just like any other endeavor, when you find partners and you can collaborate on like issues that benefit both parties, it sometimes, if not most all the time, is beneficial. So I encouraged a long, long time ago our council to become active, become a member of the chamber, and have a foot under the tent, I guess, and it's paid off quite well.
Many of a foot or a nose? or both? I suppose it worked either way.
I think we just dove right in.
Okay, okay.
Many are surprised that Dick and I have such a good working relationship, as we're sometimes viewed as being on the opposite side of the policy or political aisle. And sometimes we have agreed to disagree. In fact, we agree to disagree on many occasions, but we do such in such a way that always retains our partnership on those issues that we can work together on. We've agreed that by not working together, we stand to miss great opportunities in our marketplace, the St. Paul area's economy.
And we're very successful in, if we are dedicated to finding ways that we can agree and issues that we can agree on, because economic development is so encompassing in our community and so important to our community. But as we go through our exercise and coming together and finding out just what it is that we feel is important that we can both benefit from, we've learned that neither one of us roll over very easy. We need to talk about what our importance are, what we expect to get out of the endeavor, how much commitment we intend to put to it, and where we intend to end up. And fortunately, we always intend to end up victorious, And sometimes we got there, and sometimes we haven't. But on my side, I've got membership that counts on me and leaders like me around the state to do the best we can for these efforts. And I expect that and know that the chamber has the same kind of constituencies.
Some of the common policy issues that we've worked on in the past decade include the area of transportation, and we'll talk more about that in a moment, but a significant emphasis on transportation, energy policy, economic development, and even a bit in health care.
As you can see, transportation, energy, economic development, health care, all things that are very important to workers, being able to get themselves back and forth to work, be able to afford the energy to heat their homes and fuel their vehicles and do it properly in terms of protection of the environment. And, of course, economic development issues just come up every single day in city and local governments, which need to be addressed and fostered. And support of local politicians is very important that support these initiatives. It causes us to become politically involved. And as Larry said, most times we don't agree, but on some issues like elected of supporting different people. But when it comes down to economic development issues, we have in the past supported candidates for office that support these common goals. And, of course, health care is important to everyone, and so it just makes sense to collaborate and get as much bang for the buck as you can for our constituencies.
We just wanted to spend a moment talking about some specific issues that we work together on, and I'll concentrate first and foremost on transportation projects and policy. The Central Corridor, organized labor, and us stand together on the development of the Central Corridor. I'm proud to have led a coalition of business and labor and other interests, including the University of Minnesota, in pushing the Central Corridor project forward, and we've done so in concert with the labor community. Home and field. We wear a button today that we used about a year ago, demonstrating our continuing support of air travel, air freight, and the development of airport facilities to ensure that our economy stays strong here. And one more project that's really important to us this past fall, the business community led by the Chamber of Commerce and other business interests, as well as the labor community, came together on the MVES amendment, and we were proud to be campaign partners in that that issue. Not all of the business community, not all of the labor community was supportive of that, but the vast majority was, and, of course, we prevailed on that and very proud of that effort to make that happen.
Also unique to the city of St. Paul was the XL Energy Center, which took several years for us in partnership to work with city elected officials and the mayor at the time, Mayor Coleman, to bring that to fruition. Anytime that you're downtown on a hockey game night, you can see that the results of that hard work and the collaboration turned St. Paul to a more vibrant and vital city, and we're very happy to have been part of that. Also, the Housing 5000 initiative started by Mayor Coleman and fulfilled by Mayor Kelly. Huge endeavor for all of us to get behind that. It's to build 5,000 units of housing in the political process, the neighborhood process that's involved in going through all of those constituencies to get approvals for sometimes five housing units is very difficult, but 5,000 in 4 years was an incredible task, which was accomplished, and I'm very happy to have been part of that. Another one that's on the horizon, of course, is the Bridges of St. Paul. As I stated earlier, I'm not at the helm of the St. Paul Building Trades Council anymore, but my successor and former partner, Harry Melander, is, I believe and hopefully, I know that he's very active in support of the bridges along with the chamber, and we hope to provide great economic benefit to the city of St. Paul in the future over that project in whatever form it ends up being built in.
Other projects include our support for the Lawson Commons development and efforts to bring a resolution to the Minnesota Twins situation. In our particular case, strong support for an East Metro location. That's one of those we may not have succeeded on, but yet one we were very proud to undertake as a team. I want to thank all of you for giving us the opportunity to share some of these highlights with you. Hopefully it has been helpful to the committee. Chairman Metz and members of the committee, thank you for allowing us to be here today.
And if I could, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, there's a few points that are that I'd like to leave you with that are absolutely essential to a successful partnership. One of them is you must really want to do it. If you don't want to do it, your whole heart isn't in it, and you don't have the backing of your constituencies to give you that, it probably won't work. You have to be able to separate those issues that you don't want to, that you don't think are as common as the ones, then you have to be able to separate those and focus on the issues that will make your community better for both labor and business. You must be very respectful of the other side in terms of your conduct during these efforts, in terms of your commitment to it, being there when you say you'll be there. And finally, I'd like to just say that it's occasionally okay to talk about these things over an adult beverage.
Business community would agree with that. Thank you.
Has there been an example of a or the union group ever belonging to a chamber of commerce?
Mr. Chairman, I'm happy that you asked that because we do encourage it, and I believe we have 10 regional councils across the state, and I think at least 6 of them are. I know that a great example of cooperation between the building and construction trades in Duluth and the Duluth chamber is very strong. They're very advocate on each other. They see the value up there as we have in this in our area.
Well, the idea here was to hear about the partnership created here and that the business and labor community can get along. And you've showed us a couple of wonderful examples of how working together gets jobs created. We appreciate it. Any questions of...
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Carlson is up to NFL 897. We're just going to have some
discussion here this afternoon. And Senator Carlson.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Hand. Or Senator Michelle.
Ooh, man.
Well, you're both handsome.
He's not even on this committee.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, while they set up, I just wanted to be clear. Where is this bill? And we're just going to hear testimony today. Is that right?
Yeah, we're just going to talk about the benefits of this huge development here. And then... for discussion only, then it's going to move over to Tax Committee and see what if there's any help to be given in that area.
Senator Carlson.
My God.
Mr. Chair and members.
Yes. Hello. Welcome.
You're about to hear an interesting story, a good story for Minnesota. You're going to hear from a well-respected company with a visibility in Minnesota. They are requesting a partnership with the intent to make a major investment in the metro area. To present and explain, I have some helpers here. Mr. Rick King, who is the Chief Operating Officer of Thompson North American Legal, and later we will hear from Labor. They are also in support of the project. We also have in the audience, we have people from the Dakota County. We have people from the City of Eagan. We have the City Administrator. We have the Mayor here. And if there are any questions, we can go to those folks. But first, what we'll hear is the story from Mr. King.
Mr. King, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and committee members.
Thompson is a proud member of the Minnesota business community, and on behalf of our 6,800 Eagan-based employees, I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today. I want to speak to you about three things today and close by asking for your support. First, our company's history in Minnesota. Second, our campus expansion. And third, the strong economic benefits generated by our project. I'd like to share with you some of our history in case you don't know. Since being founded by John B. West in 1872 in downtown St. Paul, West has grown to become the leading provider of information and workflow solutions in the United States legal market. In 1991, we moved from St. Paul to Eagan, and by the end of that year, 4,000 employees were working for West in the new location. In 1996, we were acquired by the Thompson Corporation. Some of you may think of us as a legal publisher, and we are. We have one of the largest printing facilities in the country on our 264-acre campus in Eagan. 700 people work in this printing facility, three shifts, 5 days a week, printing more than 50 million books a year. While creating and printing law books are the roots of the business, this does not accurately reflect our current business activities. Today, more than 70% of our revenues come from electronic products, software, and services. Many West products, like Westlaw, have become synonymous with the successful practice of law globally. Thompson West is the largest Thompson business, and Eagan is the largest Thompson location. Eagan is not only the headquarters for Thompson West and Thompson's North American legal business, it is also a key technology center for Thompson worldwide, even outside of the legal market. We believe our growth in Minnesota is directly related to the high-caliber employees we hire here and the quality of life our state provides. We've managed rapid employee growth during the past 10 years. Organic growth, acquisitions, and site consolidations have added 1,400 employees in the last 10 years. As I said before, we now have 6,800 employees who work on the campus. Of those, 1,400 are technologists and 800 are attorneys. Our state-of-the-art data center and highly skilled technology employees are very important to our efforts, and more importantly, the drive to online information today. Our success is not only benefiting Thompson, but also the community. We have a long tradition of local civic partnerships, from our support of local schools and charities to collaborative relationships with the City of Eagan and Dakota County. We have helpful relationships with local fire and safety professionals and load sharing agreements with Dakota Electric to help them meet demand during their peaks. Local officials tell us we are a good neighbor and a good company that they want to see grow. Now I want to cover the second point, our campus expansion. We're excited about our proposed expansion that will bring an estimated 2,000 jobs to Eagan by the end of 2012. These are exactly the kind of jobs every state would love to have to compete economically. These are brain-power jobs with an average annual salary of $70,000. By the end of 2012, we expect this expansion will add $150 million in annual payroll, a figure that is almost certain to grow as the global demand for information and data technologies grow. This industry has the potential to be as important to the future of Minnesota as agriculture, financial services, and medical devices are to our past and present. This more than $100 million capital investment will build 505,000 square feet of office and data center space. As you can see by the architecture drawings, this office building will be a significant addition to our corporate campus and will enhance Minnesota's position as the key center for Thompson's growth now and into the future. Now for the third point. This project delivers a strong economic return to Minnesota. We're proposing an expansion of our Thompson West campus in Minnesota because Without a doubt, Minnesota is a great place to live and do business. But Thompson West must make sure the expansion makes economic sense as well. We have to look at the cost of creating 2,000 jobs in Minnesota. Under the expansion plans approved by our board of directors, Minnesota meets all the criteria for investment that will keep us cost competitive, but only if we're able to build the proposed partnership with state and local governments. Once the new facility is completed, we estimate the state will recover its investment in 3 to 4 years through increased income and other taxes. More importantly, though, the state is assuring that a leader in global information industry, a 21st century industry that expects continued strong growth, will remain anchored in Minnesota. We have a great business here, and we want to expand here. Our business argument shows that this partnership benefits all areas of Minnesota. The economic benefit is clear. Our expansion promises to offer a good return for the state. Minnesota wants to be a brain power state. Thompson is a brain power company. This expansion is an opportunity for Minnesota to solidify that position. We ask you to support our expansion and help bring a proposed 2,000 additional knowledge workers to Minnesota. I thank you for your time, and I'll be glad to answer any questions that you might have.
Any questions of Mr. King? Okay. You have another witness or two, Senator Carlson?
Yes. Before we go on, I want to say that this is a big project. There is an estimate of the payback, which is 3 to 4 years, I think we've said. It is probably shorter than that, in that this is a major investment which is going to employ a lot of contractors, a lot of construction people. It will bring an immense amount of money into the metro area that otherwise would not come here if West wouldn't build. The probability is that once you make this investment and bring these 2,000 jobs in, we're talking about, with benefits and salaries, somewhere around $200 million a year, additional payroll. This is a major expansion in Minnesota for a rather minor partnership on our part. This is a company that is rated one of the 100 best places to work in IT by Computer World for 6 consecutive years. It's listed as one of the 100 best companies for working mothers. It's also has an award of the best employers for workers over 50 from AARP. When you talk about a concentration of a number of jobs, this in a location like this, there's an ancillary type of development that happens with restaurants, with transportation, with hotels, with the people that come in to visit Thompson West. They bring in people from all over the world to stay in the hotels, to eat in the restaurants. So this is it's a major surrounding effect that happens with this kind of campus investment. Now what we have also is Mr. Harry Melander, who is going to speak about the union benefits of investing in locally here. One other thing I want to say that is an addition, and that is that Thompson West is such a good community partner that they've donated land that's worth today about $5 million to the YMCA, which is located just off of their campus. This is something that they use for their it's like a athletic complex. They decided not to run one within their building, and they donated the land for the YMCA, and the YMCA provides their exercise equipment for them. So with that, I'm going to ask Mr. Melander to
Senator Michelle, before...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this is for Mr. King, so I don't mean to cut in front of you, Mr. Melander, but, you know, my assumption, actually my fear, is that Thompson has many choices. You have many options. You don't have to stay in Minnesota, or you can choose to expand this operation elsewhere. So I want to tee up that question for you, Mr. King. Why Minnesota? Because we're going to make you jump through some hoops, probably. I hope not too many. It sounds like an exciting project, but why Minnesota?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Senator. there are a number of us here that run the local business, and our objective, among being the good corporate steward of the finances, was to see if we could make Minnesota work. Minnesota already has the largest collection of employees in Thompson, and in order to do so, our meetings with Deed and so forth, we were able to put together a partnership arrangement that we basically think allowed us to go to our corporation in good conscience and as Minnesota residents and propose preemptively that this is the best deal for the corporation, given the partnership. We have not spoken to other state governments anywhere. We have locations domestically of varying sizes in 400 other places. We have 200 other locations around the world outside of the United States. So we certainly do have some options, but our view was in a partnership that's been proposed that Minnesota is in the pole position, and given the nature of the partnership, if endorsed, we feel comfortable that we can proceed.
Mr. Chair, just a follow-up comment. I think from earlier testimony this year from different businesses and different industries, we've learned sometimes it's easier to help those companies that are already here to expand than to try to go out and pick someone new and recruit to Minnesota. So I hope we can be helpful to these folks.
This is only a five-year effective bill, right? I mean, it expires
yes.
at 2012?
That's correct. It goes from the end of 2006 to the end of 2011. Or January 1st, 2000.
And there's no, just a sales tax, is that correct? There's no TIF district or anything else? It's just
at this point, that's what we're asking for. Senate File 897 is simply a sales tax exemption for the materials and for all materials used in the expansion.
Yeah, I understand. And the equipment, too, which is.
Yes.
Okay. I think we've done some similar projects over the years, so. Mr. Melander, how are you doing?
Good. Thank you, Senator.
Good.
Chairman Metzen, committee members, my name is Harry Melander. I'm the Executive Secretary of the St. Paul Building and Construction Trades Council. Earlier, as President Anfang indicated, our organization represents 14,000 well-trained, qualified construction workers in the East Metro area and throughout the state of Minnesota. I'd like to speak briefly about the partnership that we've had with Thompson and the excitement that we have for this project. Construction projects like the one Thompson West is proposing are important to Minnesotans and especially important to construction economy. They employ men and women who pay taxes and raise families and buy services. The Thompson West Eagan campus expansion will require approximately 350,000 work hours for construction workers. This is a significant project that will provide good-paying jobs for trade people over the next 2 years. At any time over the course of this project, nearly 200 building trades members will be working on the Thompson site. This includes electricians, carpenters, painters, plumbers, pipe fitters, and other highly skilled tradespeople. We have a strong history with Thompson West. The most recent data center expansion project in Eagan in 2005 required 160,000 work hours and provided work for over 200 building trades people. We are anxious to the partners with Thompson West again to build a facility that will provide a space necessary to add an estimated 2,000 workers by the end of 2012. We're very excited about this continued relationship we have with this organization. This is nothing new to us. They've worked with us for many years and just appreciate the opportunity once again to provide a quality product for Thompson West. Thank you, Senator.
Have we mentioned the payback a couple of times? I would think with the income tax paid on this thing and all these construction jobs for two, three, four years, I would put the numbers to pencil to it, but I would guess it'd be even a shorter period of time probably than
3 years you're talking about the payback, and then after that it's all gravy train, if you will, or the taxes the employees, the construction people do, and the employees later. So, I would think it'd be just a couple of years of probably. Any further questions of
Mr. Chair, if I might add to what you're saying is that, yes, I believe that that's true. When you have that many labor jobs on the site and you're purchasing that much much of materials, there's an economy that's generated just from that major investment. We're saying that it's over $100 million, and that's correct. We're looking at $100 million just in materials, or over $100 million in materials alone. And those will probably be purchased primarily from Minnesota. So that generates a lot of the ancillary effects of a major expansion like this. I'm not sure if we have had another
Senator Bach another wants to talk like in this committee, but I'm going to...
Don't let him speak, please.
Senator Bach.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, I'm enjoying the argument that you're making. Just want to make you aware of the fact that I'm going to have a bill kind of similar to this for another big project at the Mall of America. That
we could probably do two of these.
I'm hoping that we can fit it into the committee's schedule, because they also make a strong argument that the state investing some money brings back returns in a very short time frame.
Yeah, we've invested quite heavily in the past at the mall and in a couple of areas, the mall itself plus the transportation structure out there with millions and millions and millions of dollars. Oh. Senator Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman and Senator Carlson, what kind of transportation needs are you going to have? If I remember this is kind of the intersection out there is kind of nasty right now.
I think that's kind of the one Dakota County and others are looking for in the Inver Grove Heights-Egan border out there, and I've got a bill into Senator Murphy's committee that'll hopefully address the congestion thing. But so,
Mr. Chair, and Senator Murphy, yes, there's a lot of problems out there with congestion. There are some projects that the city of Egan is undertaking. They are somewhat underfunded. There is a need for upgrade of an intersection at Highway 55 and 149. There is a bonding bill that we have put in for an overpass over 155 at Argenta. And I believe that the city of Egan is right now planning to finance that project for the state highways. So there is a need for additional funding that should come from the state. You're absolutely right, if that's what you're driving at.
Well, Mr. Chairman, we're going to hear Senator Day's bill tonight in Transportation Committee. Maybe that'll fix this.
Well, they're both on 55. Aren't they Highway 55? Your bill, a little south of the city, so is it? That's a good project. Here's a wonderful project.
Oh, no, it's the governor's funding package.
Oh, that one. I thought you were talking about that project. Okay. Senator Tomasoni.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. 2,000 jobs. Is this a guarantee? Or is this an estimate? How do we know if there's...
King, probably.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator, it is our best estimate.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, is there a chance there will only be 250 or... 300 jobs?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I would say that there's a extremely slim chance of such a low number. Anything is possible as economic conditions change, but my expectation is that we will be very close to the 2,000.
Just out of curiosity, Mr. Chairman, would you be willing to do something in the area of certain amount of state assistance per job, for example, pick a number, $3,000 per job, and if you don't get up to the 2,000 jobs or 1,900 jobs or 1,800 jobs, you don't get the state assistance. Would you be willing to guarantee something like that?
Mr. Chairman and Senator, we would certainly consider any such arrangement that was equitable.
Senator Boniff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And now Senator Murphy's gone, but I was just reminding Senator Murphy that we did have a transit hearing close by out in Burnsville and heard from many citizens who talked about the need for adequate transit out that way. And I would think that that Thompson would also have a strong request from us as far as the Transportation Committee that we consider adding routes and really upping the kind of service that we're providing out to that area.
Senator Carlson, did you wish, I don't know, we don't have to hear from him, but you said the mayor is here and then I see County Commissioner Showalter here, and did you want to just at least introduce them and so we know that we have their support?
Sure. Let me first introduce County Commissioner, Dakota County Commissioner Nancy Showalter.
How are you today, Commissioner?
Chair Metzen, members, I'm excellent today. It's a great day to have a bill in front of us that helps bring approximately 2,000 jobs, not only to the state of Minnesota, but to Dakota County as well. And we appreciate the consideration that this committee and the legislature will give this project.
Thank
here
you.
To support.
I'd like to also introduce Mr. Mike McGuire, who is the mayor of Eagan.
Morning.
Chair, committee, thank you. Thanks for taking the time to listen to this bill. Really, I think Thompson West already said everything that they needed to. In terms of their role in Eagan, they are a very valued corporate member of our community. They give a lot back to our community in a lot of ways. And just to clarify on some of the transportation infrastructure issues, certainly appreciate the offer to help on Highway 149. It's a challenging transportation issue for us beyond the Thompson West expansion. But on that, there are indeed projects in place specifically to take care of the intersection that Mr. Murphy, Senator Murphy, was concerned about. And that's actually a project where on that intersection, the assessment is actually being picked up in whole by Thompson West as well. In terms of that special assessment. So it's evidence of how productive they are and how well they work with our community. And it really is a response to, you know, at one point long ago, St. Paul had Thompson West as a neighbor, and St. Paul lost them and Eagan gained them, and we gained an important corporate citizen. I think Minnesota is probably in a somewhat similar situation here today. We wouldn't want to lose Thompson West to Ohio or Texas, something like that. So I thank you for your time and your consideration of the project.
Thank you, Mayor. Questions? Further questions? Well, I think, thank you. Very exciting project, and it's about three blocks out of my Senate district, but that's all right.
That's my game, yes.
You get it, yeah. Any further comments or thoughts by... That's right. Thank you very much. We're not going to...
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
An informational meeting, and then the Tax Committee will be seeing it pretty soon, I believe.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, is then all that we're going to do be to speak to our colleagues informally about this, or does this committee...
Yeah, I think
is
that's
possible
the idea.
For us to give any kind of support? I mean, it's not before us, though, is it? Is it before taxes? Must be in the Tax Committee. Yeah, it's in Tax Committee.
Yeah, I think just inform the committee members here and I suppose the folks back at home. I think it's we're on TV today, so how big of a project this is.
Mr. Chairman, I'm already speaking to Senator Scoy.
Oh, yeah? Oh, he's a pretty important person here, isn't he?
Yeah,
in this
committee.
I got Bach and Scoy and Transportation, Murphy. Yeah. Well, we're not going to go around the table. All these people are.
Mr. Chairman, this bill will have a hearing in the Tax Committee in the next week, 2 weeks at the latest.
Thank you very much. And all right. Next,
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, who was talking?
Carlson over here.
Yeah, Carlson.
I just wanted to make sure that that's clarified. March 6th is the scheduled date for the hearing in the tax committee.
Was I accurate, Mr. Chairman?
You were right on. You were right on. Senate File 414, Senator Tomasoni.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate File 414, Mr. Chairman and committee members, is a small business growth acceleration program. Essentially what the bill does is it allocates $2 million over the biennium to MTI, which is Minnesota Technology Incorporated, for small business growth. And what it basically says is that a company with less than 100 employees qualifies for the loans, and the maximum loan can be $25,000, not to exceed $50,000, and a company that applies has to match the money. So the maximum they can get from Minnesota Technology is $25,000, so the maximum project could be $50,000. I misspoke. They aren't loans; they're grants to the companies. And the idea behind this is that oftentimes smaller companies need a little bit of a hand up, or a little bit of a help that they don't have enough money to put in themselves to get to the next step and to pick up some type of technology or some type of product or some type of business application that they need to make their company get to the next step. And so what this one does is the money goes to Minnesota Technology because they've been pretty successful at some of the things that they've been doing. And a matter of fact, they say for every $10,000 that they've invested in a company, they've been able to help these companies realize about $120,000 return. And so it seems logical that if we're going to try and grow jobs in some of these smaller businesses and turn them into bigger businesses, that we might be willing to give them a little bit of a hand up with a little bit of help here, provided that they meet some of the requirements of the bill, which are two. And one is that they have less than 100 employees, and two is that they match the money. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I just have some witnesses that will give you some examples and talk to you about the project and the bill.
Okay. May I identify yourselves for the record?
Yes, Senator Metzen, my name is Kim Roden, and I'm chair of the Minnesota Technology Inc. Board of Directors. Some of you that have been a part of state government for a while probably are familiar with MTI and our history, and been a strong partner with the state of Minnesota over many years. Over the last few years, we've been re-engineering our organization. We've moved from being a free service to a fee service, and as you can imagine, that has changed our business model. And I primarily am concerned today and wanted to have you have the opportunity to talk to a couple of business owners who have utilized the services of MTI. To me, that is probably the most important thing that you can learn from today's testimony. So with me today, I have two business leaders. The first is Tom Murphy, and he's from Egan, and the name of his company is CardSource, and his company has 75 employees. And he's going to speak for a few minutes about the importance of this gap funding that we're requesting from the state. Tom?
Thank you.
Senator Metzen, when was your money taken away? I mean, we used to...
It was during
the $5 million a year.
It used to be that we would get anywhere from $6 million per year, and I think it was even higher at one point back in the beginning of the state's economic downturn under the former Governor Ventura. That was when our first funding cut was received by the state. Several of the senators, and I think some in this room, were helpful in providing a transition grant to us of $3 million, and I'm happy to tell you that we have invested that wisely and have continued to provide services throughout the state of Minnesota. So we no longer get an appropriation, if you will, to kind of keep the lights on. The way we do that is by charging for our services. Did that answer your question, Senator?
Yeah, I'm just
I would guess that most of the legislative districts, at least all these members here, have benefited somehow or other from some of these grants over the years. I know where I come from, we're two or three along the way, and we're grateful for those in there.
Well, and that's one of the reasons we came back, because we thought this was an appropriate kind of partnership with the state where it would actually generate more jobs. It's not a general appropriation that goes into our funds to pay for staff. It's quite a different type of program that we're actually asking for. I hope I've answered your question.
Yeah, no, that's wonderful.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll turn it over now
okay.
to Tom
Murphy.
Okay,
Mr. Murphy, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Metzen. Thank you, committee chairs, or committee members, for listening to what I have to say today. I'm a small business person. We're located in Eagan, Minnesota. We're down the road, separated by maybe 10 miles from West Publishing, but I don't know how many hundred million dollars. We are on the other end of the economic scale when it comes to doing business in Minnesota. We're about a $10 million organization, about 75 employees, about 20 of which tend to be seasonal employees that we bring on board and let go in our slower times. We've been in business for many, many years. We produce credit cards, membership cards, gift cards. You've probably seen a lot of our work around. It's a business where we sell all over the country. We personalize those plastic cards and ship them out of our Eagan facility. We do so with very good paying jobs. We are very proud of the fact that we have a very large payroll in an organization. Our organization exists to serve our stakeholders, to make a positive difference in their lives personally and professionally. In order to do that, we need to make money, and otherwise we would not exist. Over the years, we've worked quite a lot with the Minnesota technology people. They've helped us with marketing. They've helped us with mentoring. They've helped us with strategic planning. And I think we are where we are today because of those types of services. This growth acceleration program that is being proposed today, I think, is really a very, very important thing for small businesses like ours in Minnesota to do business and to be competitive really nationwide and worldwide. We need a hand. We're not looking for handouts, but we need a hand. It's a partnership that I think, as the bill is written, allows business owners like myself to make really intelligent decisions on where they're spending their money, to get help, to grow jobs, to provide economic security for the people that work for us. We're certainly no West Publishing. We're certainly no Northwest Airlines or Unisys or other Eagan business that you read so much about in the newspaper these days. But we struggle with all those same issues, the global issues that those larger companies struggle with. And we need help, and we're willing to invest in our own growth. And we really believe that a program like this will help to magnify that investment to the point where the payback for the community will be a very, very strong thing. Thank you for your
Thank
time.
You very much. Say, Kim, we're in the old days where were all these exemptions, what the money cannot be used for, were they always on there? Like,
no,
funds
I don't.
May not be used for refinancing, overhead costs, new construction, renovation, equipment, computer hardware. What's left?
I mean, well,
you think if you got a good project, some of those categories should fit, but apparently there's a reason why they don't, and were they always the funds always this restrictive?
Senator Metzen, members of the committee, that's a good question that you asked. I think in prior years when we got a general appropriation from the state, there really weren't any restrictions on it. Coming back for the first time in several years and seeing if there might be a new partnership that we could develop with the state, we obviously are trying to narrow the focus and really provide the assistance that would help buy down the services of the business specialists who would come in and do the consulting on software, on management, on lean technology, on all the things that will help these manufacturing companies become more efficient and effective. So what we're trying to do is give you a fairly defined project that at the end of 2 years we could say this is what you bought and this is how many jobs you created and this is the economic impact. We certainly are open to suggestions, however, to improve any language.
I just don't want your hands to be tied too much. I mean, but you know what? If we create jobs around here, and whether it be new construction, renovation, equipment, all of it fits into my idea of helping people out. But if you can live with this, that's fine with me for a while. We'll talk about it.
Okay. I think. Thank you. We have one more business owner who would like to testify, if that would be all right.
That'd be fine.
Her name is Ann Lundstrom, and she's from Allflex. It's a company in Northfield, Minnesota, 90 employees.
Mr. Chairman.
Welcome.
Thank you, members of the committee. I've been working with Minnesota Technology for about 7 to 8 years now. We're a manufacturer company. We manufacture flexible printed circuit boards. About two-thirds of our employees are workers on the floor. A third are what we consider middle management or managers. We've grown unbelievably in the last 3 years, and I think a lot of that is due to the fact that we've been able to keep competitive in the world. Our market is the world. 20% of what we make, we ship out of the country. We have gone to Minnesota Technology for lean manufacturing for our employees. We've also done some diversity training. We have English as second language in our company also through another program. We've had leadership training. Sometimes these soft kind of non-capital investment type things are really difficult for a business owner to find the money for. In a small company, you have about 14 hats on every day, and you worry so much about the day-to-day, and you need somebody, and I think Minnesota Technology has done a great job doing this, is you need somebody to say, stop, think about a year from now. How about 2 years? How about the, oh, okay. And they really, in my case anyway, held me accountable. I was under the PBA program where one of the people for Minnesota Technology would come and visit me every couple weeks, once a month, call me. It held me to do certain things that I knew were right for the company, but my day-to-day, my employees would pull me away. And I think Minnesota Technology is a well-respected group in the state for manufacturing companies, and I think that's one of the things that's been really nice in my company is that when they've come in to do this training, they talk the talk. They come in and they know how to interact with the workers on the floor. And the workers and the managers, whoever in the company, don't see them as consultants coming in to kind of get our money. They're there to help us. They're only there to make us better. And that real sense of what they're there to do really goes out into the factory. And I think a lot of our success is because we have the right people helping us. In fact, helping us so much that I sold the company January 2nd of this year. We grew so much and we were so profitable that I got an offer I couldn't refuse. So I am retired and have had a couple months to think back on why we've been so successful. And a lot of our success was due to Minnesota Technology. And I was able to run the company like a president of a company should run it instead of just an entrepreneur and a small business owner. So I think they are the right group to do it. And I think that a plan like this, you should have the companies have some stakeholder. They should have some amount that they are willing to come forward and share with the grant. I think that's important. It makes it more credible to the owner of the company and the employees, too, when you know you're paying something.
So. Senator Rosen and Senator Bach.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Lundstrom, congratulations.
First.
How did you find out about MTI? If I may ask.
Boy, I think they came to me. I think in the late 90s they found us somewhere and they came to us. We're in Rice County. There aren't a lot of small manufacturing companies in Rice County. At least at that time they weren't, and they came to us. I did not find them.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Rosa.
Then my question is to Ms. Roden. And this is, by the way, a very good bill, and I support MTI 100%. But do you try to spread the wealth?
Yeah, Senator Rosen, Chair Metzen, yes, we do. We have a very strong database
of all the manufacturing companies in Minnesota, and we target those that fit this category of the small kind of emerging company that's soon to break out and create even more jobs. So one of the ways we've got a network of specialists throughout the state of Minnesota that work with these companies and have that database where they actually identify companies that might be in a category such as Ms. Lundstrom's company was, that would benefit from some of the services that we provide. She's mentioned a few, but just to kind of run through them again, strategic management, lean enterprise, growth management, e-business, internet technology, product development, sales and marketing, human resource management, and knowledge sharing. So those are the core products and services that we provide through MTI, through our business specialists. If we need to, we can also augment the work of our business specialists with other business specialists out in the field who might have some expertise we don't. We'll partner with those to provide the business services to the companies depending on what their needs are. So we do identify companies. We do knock on their doors. Do we knock on as many doors as we would like to, as we might have years ago? Probably not as many, but I can tell you we're doing a lot of really positive work now, and having the opportunity to have this gap funding would allow us to knock on that many more doors.
Thank you.
Senator Bach.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question, I think, is for council. Is there a reason in the appropriations section that this money goes directly to Minnesota Technology and it doesn't go to DEED for, you know, a program at Minnesota Technology? It seems to me we might want to go through the department.
I could try to answer that, too, but I'll let you answer that. Yeah, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bach, a good question. Certainly appropriate to do this. If they're not a general line item, then sometimes we don't do it. We just pass. So either way,
and Mr. Chairman,
Senator Bach,
this is a, I mean, Minnesota Technology does some good stuff. Did they ever consider that maybe if they could get a couple $1 million, it should be some kind of a low-interest or no-interest revolving loan program rather than a straight-out grant? And, you know, so that, you know, kind of like the Minnesota Investment Fund does, some money comes back and we continue to revolve through.
Go ahead.
Senator Metzen, Chair Metzen, members of the committee, I think that's a great question. It's one we've actually talked about in the last few years. One of our concerns about the loan program is that this actual funding is targeting companies that, to use a phrase of one of our business specialists, drive on by because essentially they don't have the money to invest in buying these services that will help them grow their business. So the concern we had about starting out with a loan fund is we didn't want to restrict companies that might not be able to participate if it was a loan as opposed to a grant. I think that if we were to get the appropriation and if we were to become successful and have a year or two of this under our belt, we might learn that there were more companies that might be able to do a loan. What we didn't want to do, though, is back some of those companies into a corner that might not have, frankly, the financial wherewithal. I'll just tell you a very, very brief story, Senator Bach. We did some fundraising for MTI right after we lost our state appropriation, and I was calling CEOs of companies across the state who had been helped by MTI, asking them if they'd put some money into the into our development fund. And I was struck by one of the calls that I had where the business owner said, you know, I'd love to give Minnesota Technology a charitable contribution. I just took out a second mortgage on my home to finance the expansion of my business. All the officers in my company have just done the same thing, so I'm not really in a position to make a charitable contribution. That really stuck with me because I remember thinking, these people, you know, the old saying about bacon and eggs, these people are making the contribution that the pig makes, not the contribution that the chicken makes. So, you know, I would never say no to any idea that Senator Bach has, but ideally we're in a position where we're going to not restrict who can participate based on financial ability. I hope I've answered your question.
Mr. Chairman, I'm just trying to be helpful. There's a limited amount of money, and I know Senator Tomasoni is going to have priorities to make when he gets to putting his budget bill together.
Mr. Chairman and Senator
Bach. Senator Tomasoni.
Both you, Mr. Chairman, and Senator Bach brought up good points, I think, as to the use of the money and whether or not it should be a revolving loan fund. It would seem to me if they can match the money with cash that maybe they can also do a loan. So maybe the potential here is to rephrase some of this and make it more business friendly or maybe more MTI friendly even, so that we can maybe have a pot of money that's always there for you as opposed to having to come back here all the time and trying to get more. So at any rate, I think we can do some work before we actually pass it on.
Yeah, there might be a way to be a little more all-inclusive, and maybe you can leverage it like Senator Bach. But work on the formula in the next week or so, and because this is an exciting thing. I mean, where do these small companies go? They got no place to go. And if a 25, 50 grand will put them over the hump. And
can't they get it from your bank?
I'm the loan arranger, yeah. All right, anything else? Senator Scoy, you're just listening real, real good here today. That's
listening and learning, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much, Chairman Metzen, members of the committee.
Mr. Chairman, if there's
we have to move it out of here. Oh, yeah, we'll let Senator Scheider move that. It'll be recommended to pass in File 414 and forward to the Finance Committee. And then they, on that motion, all in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed. Motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank
you very
much.
Thank you. Senator Saxhog. Senate File 804. Unemployment benefits edition.
It's my cabin, Senator.
Good thing I had my eyes open.
Yes. Senator Saxhog, welcome to the committee, Senate File 804.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Today I'm presenting Senate File 804. This bill will extend the unemployment benefits for workers for three Ainsworth, Oriented Strand Board, Mills, and Cook, Grand Rapids, and Bemidji. Mr. Chair, the timber industry is one of the major economic drivers in northern Minnesota. The three plants that were shut down created permanent layoffs to close to 400 people. These layoffs are a result of a major national downturn in the housing construction market. The problem when layoffs occur in northern Minnesota, such as these, aren't like the 11-county metro area. A person just can't go down the road and get another job, and that's the main reason we're asking for an extension at this time. I'm sure stand for any questions.
Well, again, how does this differ than maybe I will pay full attention, but I mean, this happens other places too, right? Is that correct? Or is this different in what ways again?
Well, I think, Mr. Chair, I think it's more similar in some ways to the farmland and the finger hut and the Northwest Airlines type situations where
we increased or we okay
extended.
So there has been other examples in the past.
Yes.
Senator Bach.
Mr. Chairman, I think we've frequently done this where there have been large layoffs where people have been determined to be qualified for the state's dislocated worker program, and I believe that's the case here. And the problem we have, and Senator Tomasoni and Saxhog and I have met with the Ainsworth family from Vancouver. They're very good people that own these facilities. But their success and selling their board at a profitable rate is very dependent on the national housing market. And the housing market nationally has turned down significantly, and their cost of producing the 4x8 sheets that you see in the Menards flyer every week, their cost of production is higher than the cost that they can sell it for right now because of the supply and demand market, because housing's down so bad nationally. And, I mean, Senator Saxhog is right. These people are in a difficult, difficult situation in that they once their unemployment runs out, they are going to be faced with having to do something. It's in these rural communities, and those of you that are rural know, I mean, you can't get in your car and in 30 minutes find another job. There just aren't other jobs. So people are in a situation where if if we can help them hold out a little bit longer until the housing market turns around and the plant can reopen, their job will be there for them. But it's kind of a waiting game, and in the meantime, people run out of unemployment and are forced to look into relocation or something. When we know, we're pretty sure these plants are going to reopen. It's just a matter of timing, and I think if we can kind of lend them a hand until their jobs reappear, these people want to work. And we did similar things for LTV steel employees when the steel mill shut down. It's a sad situation, Mr. Chairman, that the wood products industry is in northern Minnesota. And it's not just the individuals that work in these plants. There are more people that work out in the woods and cutting down the trees and driving the trucks to bring the trees to market. We're in pretty darn bad shape, and this is a pretty small thing, I think, that we could do to try help build a little bit of bridge until these people get a chance to get their jobs back.
I think Anderson Windows in Bayport laid off 500 people, too, in this industry about a month ago. So it's that whole housing thing is appliances, all of this stuff is just like this for a while, and we'll get out of it someday, but in the meantime, that's probably why you're here. So
that's exactly why I'm here, Mr. Chair.
All right, should we, any further discussion? Is somebody from the chamber wishes to testify in opposition to the bill? Is it David Dietrichs?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Dave Dietrichs with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. The Chamber has over 2,400 member businesses, and over 80% of those businesses have less than 100 employees. Our members represent all aspects of the economy throughout the state of Minnesota, and we have over 130 local chamber affiliates throughout the state. Thanks for the opportunity to talk to you about Senate File 804. The reason we came to talk today about this bill is we are concerned about the precedent that this bill could set. The chamber believes that UI benefits should only be extended beyond 26 weeks of regular benefits when certain criteria are met. And the criteria that the chamber has looked at for granting or extending UI benefits are the ones that are actually promulgated by the Ventura.
Senator Murphy has a question. Okay, continue on. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The criteria that we look at when extending UI benefits are actually the criteria that the Ventura administration promulgated when looking at the LTV bankruptcy situation. And those four criteria are whether the employer is officially bankrupt, the community is disproportionately affected by the employer layoff, whether the community is in a remote location where reemployment opportunities are limited, and finally, if the employees are receiving extended benefits or attending job training or education that improves or diversifies their skills. Finally, extending benefits, we believe, should be limited to 13 weeks and only be granted if not available from the federal government. And with that, I would be happy to stand for any questions. Thank you.
You said it sets a precedent. This has happened before a few times.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
See how this could be setting up. Senator Murphy.
Well, Mr. Chairman, that was my point was going to be precedent. You want a precedent? How about this? 37% of all jobs in greater Minnesota are $10 an hour or less. Why don't we change that? I like Senator Saxog's bill. I think we ought to pass it and send it to the governor's desk today.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to point out, I was looking at the summary and then I read the language in the bill, and actually I suspect that not all of those employees would even qualify, because I assume, Senator Saxog, you intend to keep in. I mean, I was looking at the element, what it takes to be eligible, and those are conjunctive, not disjunctive. On line 2.3, it says and. So they have to be enrolled in or have completed a program in reemployment assistance training in order to qualify. So that's a pretty important factor here, and I would think the chamber – that sounded like that was one of your criteria. Is that?
Well, Mr. Chairman, to Senator Scheid's point, these people are eligible for dislocated worker training. and Commissioner Ines came to northern Minnesota, I mean, probably a week after the shutdown, to announce that these employees were eligible for that. So I do think that's what unemployment, that's how we should want unemployment extensions to be used. When people are dislocated, they're going to try to retool their skills. If we can provide some help for them while they're in school, getting retrained in the area of additional unemployment benefits or a bridge or a bridge until their jobs reappear, that's what we should want to do. And Mr. Diedrich, I would think that the chamber would pick their fights more carefully.
Senator, Mr. Chair.
Senator Saksak.
To that point, approximately 200 workers are currently enrolled in the state dislocated workers program. And each week about 20 additional workers are being enrolled as the training becomes available.
Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I distinctly remember this issue from years ago, and Commissioner McElroy at that time chaired the House Jobs Finance Committee, and I was on that committee, and we had all sorts of the extension requests. We had LTV. There was one for a food processing place down in southern Minnesota, there was a lot of these, and I remember during the Ventura administration when we all wrestled with the fact of, at that time, there wasn't a precedent. I think there maybe was one in the 1950s, but there wasn't a lot of these extensions. There wasn't any extensions granted. So it wasn't until just a few years ago when we started down the road granting a lot of these, and I thought that at the time that criteria made some sense, and although it was counterproductive to my own district because that criteria clearly eliminates anything in the metro area. So I was going along and agreeing that there should be some criteria, some threshold, some hurdle to go over. Again, it was counterproductive to my own district, but it made sense. I'm not so sure that we want to. I mean, I clearly see the passions and what's going on in rural Minnesota with Senator Bach and also with what Senator Murphy is saying, but there's a lot of wisdom in having some criteria and having some threshold. So I wonder if Senator Saksog, based on that criteria, if you don't agree with me that there ought to be any kind of a criteria for this, but does your situation, how does it match up against that criteria that we've sort of been trying to use as a guideline over the last few years?
Senator Saksog.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Gerlach, I think I didn't have a list of the chamber's criteria, but as I listened to them, it seemed to me that we matched up with them quite nicely.
Senator Gerlach, did you have a follow-up?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, a follow-up question. Then, Mr. Dieter, is that your read on it as well? How does that match up with the criteria? If you've done an analysis on this, how does it match up based on that criteria?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I have not been able to go through all of the various criteria point by point, but I do not believe that under the first criterion that Ainsworth is officially bankrupt.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
we
want them to stay open until they are. I mean, and then shed their pension obligations to the Pension Guarantee Board in Washington, D.C. I mean, the Ainsworth family made the right decision before they let their company go into bankruptcy because of the national housing crisis, they shut the plant down so that they can stay a viable corporation once the housing market turns back up. I mean, we shouldn't force the company into bankruptcy before their employees can get an unemployment extension. That seems like an odd criteria.
Gerlach, did you have a Senator Gerlach?
Yes. Mr. Chairman, yes. To that, then I don't know what the right answer is on this. But if that criteria is not sufficient that was established a few years ago, if bankruptcy now is counterproductive to what we're trying to do by preserving jobs or keeping companies open, then it doesn't fit. And then that shouldn't be one of the criteria. But what I would just suggest is that somehow, whether it's within this committee or whether it's in the department or something, that we somehow figure out what a proper measuring stick is on these. Otherwise, why do we have the 26 limit in our UI laws? Why do we even have that if we are going to, without any criteria, just simply grant extensions every time someone petitions the legislature? What is our how are we exercising any judgment on this? And again, I don't know whether that particular one about the bankruptcy, whether that makes sense or not, but it had been sort of a guiding principle the last few years. So I don't have any more questions, but I would just say if we're going to go down this road with future businesses and this issue, we really should figure out a way to measure this and to judge this properly. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Rosen, did you have a...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would happen to agree with Senator Gerlach that perhaps we have to set up some measurements because shame on me for not doing my homework. I could think of several situations out in rural Minnesota that would fit under these criteria right now. For example, one in Senator Vickerman's district, Swift Companies. So I feel bad for the Ainsworth Lumber Company, but I'm not sure if we're going to be opening this up to a whole bunch of different situations.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Well, Mr. Dietrichs had four conditions. One was bankruptcy, and we probably have decided that might not be the best thing to ask this company to go into. And the fourth one was training, and that one is provided for in the legislation. I think the second one was that the communities are remote. Most of this logging activity is occurring out in the forest, and they're in fairly remote communities. And, I think as far as the community effect, if you travel into these areas, as Senator Bach has talked about, not only it's the workers in these plants, but it's truck drivers and loggers, and there's a pretty wide-ranging negative economic impact going on up there, and if we can help some of these workers by expending their unemployment benefits until Ainsworth can get their feet on the ground or they can get retrained to do something else in one of the regional centers of northern Minnesota, I really would think it would be a good thing.
Well, Mr. Sherman, maybe I can help with the magnitude of this. The plant that I'm most familiar with is right on the outside the city limits of the little town of Cook. The little town of Cook, where I was born and raised, has 600 people live there. 130 people work in this plant. So you can guess what the impacts are to a small community like that. And then we add to that the people out in the woods. Take that out of the 600, because they're not working now, because they can't truck the wood to the mill. They're not cutting the trees down. Foresters aren't putting paint on the trees. And the impact to a small town is significant.
Senator Tomasoni.
Mr. Chair, one of the other criteria is that there has to be more than 50 people that have been laid off, so it has to be a significant number. I think there's some things that we begin to do with this bill, is my understanding after talking to the department a little bit. So I would move that Senate file number 804 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance. I think there's a couple of things we might have to deal with, and I'm willing to work with some people to see if we can get those things worked out.
We can do that. I don't think it needs to go to finance, but if that's where you want it to go, we can do it that way. I just want to see the thing pass. So. You want it to go to finance? Is it right with you, Senator Saksak? I'm trying to speed it up for you a little bit here, but we're like the judge and jury here. I mean, we make these decisions on an individual basis. We're not going to – certainly there could be other ones coming forward, Senator Rosen and others, but we'll take a look, but we're not doing these – one of these session. We might do one or
– And, Mr. Chairman, we're very willing to sit down with Deed, and if there's some things that we can agree on that may make a few changes in this bill, I think we should do it.
All right. That is fine with me if you want to – yeah. Okay, on the Tomasoni motion to refer this bill to the Finance Committee, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
The next bill, we're going to be considering this afternoon. It'll be Senator Higgins' bill, Senate File 443. Scrap metal dealers, record keeping, and registration requirements. Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, I have the A5 delete all amendment, and I have a couple of oral amendments to start out to get it in the shape that I think it needs to be in. So if they would pass out the A5.
Just want to add that right away and then just talk about the whole bill.
Or yes.
This is the bill.
This is the bill, yes. Or this will be the bill after you vote on it. But I would like to insert after line 1.8. Does everybody have them? A new number one that would say copper, aluminum, or any other metal commonly used in construction. Copper, aluminum, or any other metal commonly used in construction. Then on line 2, or page 2, line 3, I would like to move the beginning of the sentence, the phrase that says, for the purpose of promoting the public health, safety, morals, and welfare, and start the sentence with a municipality. So with those two oral amendments, if somebody would move the amendment, I'd appreciate it.
I'll move those amendments.
Senator Murphy.
What was the second one?
What was the oral amendments, I guess? Just tie me up.
Mr. Chairman, could she repeat the second part of that?
The second amendment is on line 2.3. Delete the opening phrase up to the comma on line 2.4.
Okay. Senator Latz.
Since we should do this all together, I think with a new number one, on line 1.8, we probably need to renumber the remaining subparagraphs. Yep.
That's true. Thank you.
Okay. On the Murphy Amendment, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed. Motion prevails. Now, that was the amendment to the amendment. Clarifying language there. Do we have to move the, or did we move the whole thing? Did we move the whole thing? Yeah. Okay, I guess we moved the whole,
okay.
Whole amendment. Senator,
all right. Mr. Chair, and I have a handout when the page has a minute. Theft of metal that can be sold to a scrap metal dealer has reached epidemic proportions in Minnesota. This bill attempts to shut off the outlet to sell stolen goods. People who will testify here today will show why we need this piece of legislation. You'll hear of thousands of dollars lost through theft of building materials, houses that explode when some fool cuts the copper gas line in the basement, and rolls of copper wire disappearing overnight from work sites. The existing statute that vaguely connects to this problem was written in 1904. It calls for kind of gentle regulation. It talks about how reports need to be written neatly in ink and mailed to the sheriff's office. The A5 amendment that you just adopted would bring this industry into the 21st century. It would require electronic reporting to a system that's used commonly in the pawnbroker business called the automated pawn system. The amendment, the bill, would exempt 5 types of transactions. They are listed starting on page 1, line 28, and going through 35. The transactions that would be exempt are transactions that involve the purchase of aluminum food and beverage containers. I don't think anybody wants to go after the Boy Scouts and their can drives. Transactions involving the purchase of industrial scrap metal that's transported under the terms of a written contract. Transactions involving the purchase of scrap metal that is sold by people who can demonstrate that producing scrap metal is a byproduct of their business. For instance, aluminum siding contractors, demolition contractors, people like that. I wanted to exclude motor vehicles. And I'd like to exclude transactions where the payment is $75 or less. That gets us down to a much smaller group of transactions than the original bill would have covered. So the bill now would require that every scrap metal dealer would register with the Department of Public Safety. That starts on line 2.22. And at this time, there really is no definitive list of who all the scrap metal dealers are in this state. And so when we have found, when police departments are trying to find an item like the little statues that were stolen from Theodore Worth Park a couple of weeks ago, they wanted to let everybody know to be on the outlook for them. But there were they really didn't have a list. They kind of knew who was in the metro area, but they didn't know the rest of them. So this would require that everybody register with the Department of Public Safety. It also would require that municipalities that have a scrap dealer within its boundaries would license and regulate that industry within their municipality. Some already do. And the requirements of that are somewhere here in this bill. I'm sorry. You'll find it. The dealers would have to record information about the transactions. That starts on page 3. And I believe this fairly closely matches the information that's already gathered for pawn transactions. Some of it sounds a little strange. The description of the seller, including approximate height, weight, eye color, hair color, sex, and race. But we also are requiring to have a videotape of that and a picture of the driver's license, and that information will be fairly available in some form. So it's not as weird as it may look on first blush. The transaction information would be updated each day to the APS system. Law enforcement could then review the information and track down the leads that look promising to them. Right now, they drive from place to place to place and look at the piles of stuff that are there. I think police officers have a lot better things to do rather than drive from scrapyard to scrapyard, especially when there is a computerized system available. This bill would put in place a 5-day holding period. And I know that the dealers don't like that provision, but if we're going to report it and have any time for anybody to track down some leads, there needs to be a holding period so that it's still there and not destroyed before they get there to look at it. Subdivision 10 also talks about if law enforcement believes that the property was stolen or it's evidence in a crime, they can put an administrative hold on it. The provisions are there spelled out. The bill also says that there would be video security cameras required at each licensed location. We want the cameras to record the face of the person doing the transaction, the vehicle, and then, of course, there's some language saying that, let's keep the video camera in good condition so we can actually, use the data that's stored there. Subdivision is 12 is criminal penalties, and this committee or this bill will have to go to judiciary, so I suspect that we probably don't need to spend much time on that in this committee. The last couple of subdivisions in the bill talk about the transition to the new system that this bill would put in place, and then also state that this does not preempt or supersede an ordinance adopted by a municipality that is more restrictive than this bill. Mr. Chair, I have a lot of people who are very interested in this bill and would like to see it passed. And from the city of Minneapolis, we've got Bob Scom, a couple of police officers who have been working on this issue for a long time. Bob Scomra and Officer Scoro, Tom Deegan, who's the head of the Problem Properties Unit in the city, Mary Peterson, who runs the APS system for the city. Minneapolis has used the PON system for close to 15 years now. We also have Bonnie Lunzer from Parsons Electric, who would like to talk to you about what they're seeing in their business. Gary Faden from the National Electrical Contractors Association is here supporting the bill. I think we have somebody from the aggregate businesses who are here supporting the bill. And at this time, if we could have some testimony from those folks, I'd appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Senator Higgins. If I just might ask, it looks like in your amendment today that you did add some exclusions that were not in your original bill.
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Thank you very much. Why don't we start with our first person on the list today is Tom Deegan from the Minneapolis Problem Properties Unit. And welcome,
Madam
Mr.
Chair.
Deegan.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a couple of questions for Senator Higgins.
Sure.
Could you clarify in Subdivision 9 the holding period? Are you saying that any time there is a transaction with scrap metal that the purchaser has to hold on to the scrap metal for 5 days?
And Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, Senator Bonoff, for the transactions that are not covered by the exemptions on page 1, the bottom of page 1, which are the business in, transactions, the industrial scrap metal, those kinds of things.
And Senator, Madam Chair, Senator Higgins, is that a problem for, have you heard from these businesses whether or not that's a problem in terms of having the space to hold on to this? I know that, you know, general business practice, just-in-time inventory, things like that where you want to turn it very quickly.
Madam Chair, Senator Bonoff, yes, they don't like that provision.
Another
but I think it's necessary, Madam Chair, Senator Bonoff, if we are going to actually, if it's going to be there when law enforcement goes to see if it's, you know, something that's been stolen, kind of has to be there for a couple of days.
Madam Chair, Senator Higgins, so you think it is critical to this?
I think it really is, Madam Chair, Senator Bonoff.
And then another question from Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Higgins, and to the testifiers that are coming up. You know, I know it's a problem, this theft of metal off of building sites, but we also need to think about what solution is going to be the best to, you know, to not have that occurring. And is really the best approach to this, and I'd ask the testifiers to think about this if they have some assistance for me, it would be helpful. Is there any other mechanisms that we can use besides going after the scrap dealers? You know, this is already an illegal action that these people are doing, and is there other mechanisms that would be more effective? Because, you know, the other thing that we do know is that, you know, there might be thefts and the sale might not occur, you know, right away and that sort of thing. So I just like people to kind of open up their thoughts a little bit here and see if there aren't some other activities that we can do to try to stop this without, you know, because the scrap dealers really aren't part of that other than they're trying to do their business and scrap is part of their business.
And that's a good point, Senator Scoy, in that I think today we certainly want to listen and learn from both sides. There's certainly a problem here, and I think finding the real solution is why we're listening to this today. So thank you. So, Senator Higgins, if you could introduce your first.
Madam Chair, this is Tom Deegan from the Problem Properties Unit in the city of Minneapolis.
And welcome, Mr. Deegan, if you would identify yourself for the records.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, committee members. Tom Deegan. Currently, I am the manager of the Problem Property Unit within the city of Minneapolis. The scope of our duties is to deal with problem landlords, but more specifically, those properties that go vacant within our city, become condemned, and or boarded. Prior to this particular position I held in the city, I was with Minneapolis Fire for 30 years, and the last 5 years as their fire marshal. What I'd like to show you today, and I got to apologize, I thought maybe we'd have a way of me showing my pictures on an overview. So what I'll do is it's four different addresses, and as I explain those, I'll pass these around so
Paige will get them.
You can kind of get an idea of what's going on in our city. And the other thing I want to talk about is the, and maybe it's particular to Senator Scoe's question, is that what have we been doing so far to try to resolve some of these problems? We work with Minneapolis Police Department for those thefts in vacant and boarded buildings that have or allegedly have had stolen copper piping taken out of them. We work with CenterPoint Energy because they do a gas response under 911 for any type of gas type issue that occurs within a property. And we are attempting to work with the mortgage industry. The mortgage industry is a vested partner in this particular crime in that a lot of these properties that we currently have, once they go vacant, there is an owner. Usually it's a mortgage company. They're not aware of the problem, and it does affect their bottom line. I won't pass those lists around because they probably wouldn't mean a lot other than a person like me. The other thing I'd like to state is that currently in the city of Minneapolis, we have approximately 400 buildings that are in our registered vacant boarded building list. Of those, about 25% of them have had the copper stripped out of them. Let's see. One of the properties that you have is 3407 Fremont. The points I'd like to make on that one are that allegedly the copper was stripped out and subsequently a fire. I don't know who has those pictures, but the public safety hazard to firefighters is the biggest concern in that one. The other property in question was 1931 Morgan, and what was going on there is we had a new property owner, and they went through a rental license inspection in Minneapolis, and orders were written, and the follow-up inspection, somebody had broken in and stolen the copper and filled the basement full of water. Consequently, the property is destroyed, and it's going to have to be removed.
So how is this removed? Can you explain a little bit about the procedures that are used to remove the wire?
In these cases that we're seeing, basically they go in with a portable battery-operated tool, hacksaw, saber saw, something like this, or simply, thank you, or simply a pipe cutting device that you could carry in your pocket. Many of these buildings that we've secured are done with 3-inch tamper-proof screws, but obviously they get some type of device, remove the board, go in under the cover of night, and no one knows they're in there. So, hence, the outlet is the scrap metal person, and oftentimes we see these folks down there 7 o'clock in the morning with shopping carts full of cut-up half-inch, three-quarter-inch pipe that roughly our estimate is about a $300 sale in a property, but the damage to that property, especially in a flooding condition, oftentimes they get condemned and get tore down. Does that help answer that question?
Thank you very much.
And the last property that I have there is a commercial building, 2623 Broadway. It's a little different situation where the people that were working there, again, illegally, were reclaiming those precious metals from computers. And subsequently, there was a gas explosion. 6 firefighters got injured. So that's why I wanted to bring that to. So if there's any questions on any
questions?
One of those properties.
Madam Chair, Mr. Deegan said Minneapolis has about 400 boarded buildings. St. Paul has 800. This is a big problem.
This is the one where the firefighters were injured, I think.
Okay, our next person to testify is Bob Skomra from the Minneapolis Police Department. And welcome.
This one just hit. Okay.
Afternoon, Madam Chair. Other committee members. Mine will be mainly historical as far as my experience goes as a police officer for the city of Minneapolis. I'm currently the inspector at the second precinct, which is everything east of the Mississippi River and north Columbia Heights to south St. Paul border and to the east city border. But I first became aware of the problem that was occurring with the copper thefts and what it was doing when I was the commander of the 4th Precinct, which is commonly referred to as the North Side. As part of my Code 4 duties, I would review all the crimes that were being committed in the precinct each day. And about 4 years ago, I started to notice a trend in the burglary of homes where the copper wires were removed and also the copper tubing that either carried water or gas. And I noticed over the time a gradual increase in that up until it's reached proportions in Minneapolis now where it's almost an epidemic. Add to what Mr. Deegan said, they go in, they use cutting tools to remove the copper pipes, but they smash walls out to get at the wiring a lot of times and the concealed copper pipe. And when I noticed that occurring on the east side of Minneapolis, I saw one case in particular, and I won't mention any company names here, but one was a large utility that actually had an outage in their service because somebody entered a service tunnel with a portable handheld skill saw and cut through live power cables. And actually, to this day, I can't understand why that person wasn't killed. The tools were abandoned at the scene. It caused an electrical flash fire that burnt the individual. We have never been able to locate this person, but it actually caused one of the utility companies to shut down service for a large part of their grid. When I talked to the people at the utility company, I found out that this had not been the first time that it had occurred. In fact, it occurred at one of our medical facilities in Minneapolis where a large medical facility was forced to go on emergency power because the same thing had been done there. And I think part of, and that was my involvement in that I was starting to worry about really the public safety of the citizens, the police officers, and also the firefighters who respond to those locations. As recently as last Friday, I talked to a patrol officer who I saw going in the courthouse with a bag full of copper tubing. And he said he had just arrested a party for that having 70 pounds of copper tubing with him. And the house, if the police officers hadn't caught him coming out of the dwelling, we may have faced another explosion because he had cut through a gas line, and the gas was running in the house when the officers arrived. We've been unfortunate to have four explosions. This could have been the fifth, and fortunate enough not to have more. And people living right next door to these locations are at risk, as well as the 911 responders. When I was fortunate enough to talk to the House Committee about this, I listened to the industry talking about self-regulation, and it is not working. We see that there are a continued source of income for these people, and with the no checks and balances at that level, they will continue to buy the copper piping, copper tubing, the wire, not knowing where it came from, and not allowing us to identify the people with an efficient manner of identifying not only property that's been taken, but also identifying the people that may be returned sellers who may be the burglars who are stripping our hoses and give us viable suspects to go after and make arrests. So this reporting that Senator Higgins has proposed would be a great asset to our detective unit in identifying repeat sellers who may be burglars, which at this time we have no idea who they are, and we are just lucky when we catch somebody because of a citizen calling us and reporting some activity. And many times even when we get those calls, because our officers are so strapped with their time, maybe we arrive 5 minutes after they've gone and we can't identify them. I've been and I'll just tie this up real quick. The $10,000 worth of statues taken from Theodore Worth Park were cut up and were going to be sold for scrap for just a little better than $300. $10,000 public project destroyed for the sake of $360. That doesn't even address the public safety issues that go along with this matter. I thank you for your time. I want to take Lieutenant Scoro off the list. I brought him over today just to give him an idea of what goes on at the legislature when they talk about bills. And I don't think he's prepared to talk.
So we appreciate him being here very much. We appreciate
him.
Thank
you very
here.
Much for your
Are
time.
Are there any questions?
Well, Madam Chair, we should give the lieutenant a Lexan certificate. Then he'll do all the talking.
Thank you, Senator Murphy. We will make note of that.
Madam Chair.
And Senator Latz, excuse me. Senator Latz.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Officer, do you know, maybe you're not the right person to answer this question, but maybe someone else here knows the answer, approximately what proportion of the business of the scrap metal dealers is involved in receiving scrap of questionable source?
Through the chair to Senator Latz, I don't even know if they can answer that themselves. But I think probably the industry would be in a better position. All we know is that one quarter of our vacant homes have been stripped of copper, and for the sake of about $300 worth of copper, which is about probably a little better than 100 pounds at today's prices. So I wouldn't think it's a big proportion of it, but I would think it's very crucial to public safety to address the issue.
Any other questions? Thank you very much. Do you have some other people testifying today? I know you had mentioned some others, Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, Bonnie Lunzer from Parsons Electric and Gary Faden.
Please come.
And I don't know, we have somebody here from the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association and the Sheriff's Association, and I don't know if they want to testify or just say that they're in support.
Okay.
And then we have Fred Corrigan from the Aggregate and Ready Mix world.
Thank you very much. If you would introduce yourself for the record, and welcome.
Thank you, Senator. I'm Bonnie Lunzer from Parsons Electric. I'm the safety director, and it's a pleasure to be here. And I just wanted to give an industry viewpoint to this. You had challenged us to say, is this the right way to go and the best solution? I can tell you that all of the construction companies, the utilities and all of the other companies that are involved in having their material being stolen have been trying for years to solve this, and we need your help. I have construction sites across the country, and I have been having things stolen across the country. We secure, we lock, we chain, we everything. I have copper being stolen off of an Air Force base even right now. So it's a pretty secure site. It took me quite a while to get in to even visit my own job site. So we're doing everything we can. When I got on this task force of some of the different industry leaders, I was very surprised there was one more thing that we could do. And that's what I've been involved in trying to get out with the AGC Safety Committee and things like that with our peers, is one of the things the police have asked us to do is, even though we have a high deductible, many of us have a fairly large deductible, maybe $2,500 per occurrence or something, we weren't reporting every single one of those if it was $1,500 or something on a particular job site. We had failed to report every one of those to the officers, thinking that we weren't necessarily turning it as a claim. Now, that was our mistake, and that's something that we're working on and correcting, because if they open someone's garage door and find a whole bunch of my copper and aluminum cable tray and everything else, they need to know that it's missing from me. So that's another thing that we're going to be doing. But we're asking your help, because it takes all of us to surround this problem. We need your help to require the documentation that allows the investigation for this. As examples, I have 500 MCM is a cable that is costing right now around $6 a foot. It was $10 a foot only 6 months ago. I might have 5,000 feet of it delivered on one delivery on one job site. That's $30,000 of cable, of copper. And if that truckload, if that amount is stolen, the amount of employees that I'm not able to have productive and working for how many days before that next delivery can be, you know, arranged for. If you're out in Benson, Minnesota, where I am right now, working on the first turkey-powered energy plant, I can't get $30,000, you know, I can't get $30,000 worth of copper delivered again 6 hours later if it's stolen. The security aspects of that. We've had people cut the fence, get into a job site, take one of our job site vehicles, like a pickup truck or something that we've got there for moving around so that we don't hurt our employees' backs moving all this stuff. They load it up on our pickup and drive that through the gate and get out. So, boy, we could use your help. I mean, 300 feet of cable tray, aluminum cable tray, was stolen 2 weeks ago before the last hearing, and that was $1,500 just for that 300 feet of aluminum cable tray. So that's just one instance out of thousands. I know Xcel Energy has mentioned how much they've been losing.
And a question from Senator Thomas.
Just out of curiosity. So in that type of an instance where it's a brand new roll of of aluminum or copper,
yes.
Do these end up in scrap yards too?
Yes. The thefts are occurring because it is so easy to turn them into cash. You can take off. We've actually, you know, you can stamp, you can everything, the wooden reels, the spools. We're not talking about somebody that comes in with one little bucket of, you know, copper. We're talking about truckloads of it. They take the wooden spool apart with the bolts and then roll it off, and there it is, brand new, still kinked in a roll, and they'll accept it at most scrapyards. If not, they've learned to steal a tool and cut it up into nice, even little, you know, two-foot pieces, all shiny, brand-new two-foot pieces, and they have an entire pickup truck full of it. But no questions are asked, and they're given cash for it.
Can you hire these guys? They sound pretty good.
So it's just an epidemic issue that, you know, it's the houses, it's the construction companies. You know, we're building buildings all over the state and all over the country, and it's got to start somewhere, and I hope it starts here, that we can, you know, help our employees even have something to do tomorrow because their materials aren't stolen.
Thank you, Ms. Lunzer. Are there any questions for Ms. Lunzer before we go to our next witness? All right. Mr. Thayden, please introduce yourself.
My name is Gary Thayden. I am the Government Affairs Director for the Electrical Contractors Association, which Parsons is a part of, but also the Minnesota Mechanical Contractors Association, which do plumbing and heating throughout the state of Minnesota. These people will cut up spools, just like she was talking about. We have not only job sites, but construction shops. And if you leave a vehicle inside the shop, generally the fire insurance company will say, well, you have to leave the keys in the vehicle so that in case the fire starts in the shop, you can drive the vehicle out. So they break into the shop. They throw a bunch of stuff into the back of the pickup. They get in and turn the ignition on because you got to leave the keys in there, and they drive the truck out. So we provide them the means of getting rid of the stuff, too. And that's because our fire insurance tells us we have to do it that way. So there's lots of ways that these people can get this stuff. There are, unfortunately, the scrap yards is the choke point. And that's where it all comes together. And that's why we need to regulate that industry.
Thanks. And are there any questions? Our next testifier, please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Fred Corrigan. I'm Executive Director of the Aggregate Ready Mix Association. I don't have a lot to add to what the former speakers have mentioned to you, except that a lot of our locations, especially in the aggregate locations, are closed down during the winter, and a lot of the equipment that's left in those sites behind locked, fenced facilities are left with equipment. And I think the thing that you've heard today that's really so appalling is that a lot of this material will be sold for hundreds of dollars and will cost tens of thousands of dollars to repair again in the spring. Whole equipment is just destroyed, and new equipment in some cases has to be purchased, or at least the repair cost of going back in and rewiring this equipment and a lot of the switches, especially, that haven't been mentioned to you today, because the switches also have a lot of this material in them. And again, as you've heard today, these switches, which are very unique switches that can be $10,000 switches, there's only one purpose for them. They come off construction equipment, are being taken in whole. They're not being taken apart, and they're able to sell these switches for hundreds of dollars again. So it's really an issue of trying to keep equipment running and finding a way to deal with this problem. I think one of our members in Apple Valley had spent some time with the police chief. We have done what we hope we can do. We have cameras on a lot of our sites, especially in the more urban areas, and we have problems with ATVs and other things on our aggregate sites where we do have cameras as well. So we, in some cases, know that the same person is going into this yard week after week after week, and at least the Apple Valley police chief said that isn't enough evidence for him to have a reason to go into the scrapyard and to follow that person into that business location. So whether this is exactly the right solution or not, as you've heard before from all of the previous speakers, this is a problem that's costing hundreds of thousands of dollars, if not millions of dollars a year, in lost material and in repair costs. Thank you.
Other questions for Mr. Cordigan? All right, Senator Higgins, do you have some other people here today that you mentioned who would like to come forward?
Only if the chiefs and sheriffs want to speak, I think.
It looks like they're going to come forward.
Well, come on up. Did you just get here?
No,
I've been in the back. Okay.
We always like to see the East Metro represent as well, officer. So thank you for being here. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Senators, I'm Sergeant Paul Ford. I'm an investigator with the St. Paul Police Department. I investigate these crimes. Today I was putting together our January statistics. 25% of the burglaries on the east side of St. Paul involve vacant houses and copper. Part of the problem is by the time we get there, the copper's gone, the suspects are gone. There's very little or no evidence. You need to catch these people inside for any successful prosecution, and even then it can be difficult. We did a deal last week. One of our investigators, we had a St. Paul Police Department ladder. It was aluminum broken. We cut it up. We brought it to a local scrapyard with the City of St. Paul sticker on it. The scrapyard accepted it. We had another package of copper the same investigator, he brought to a local scrapyard. It was cut up similarly how we've seen this copper. When we have recovered it, he brought it to a local scrapyard. Initially, they wouldn't take it. He had no ID. He offered them that he would take less than what the market value was, and then at that point, they agreed to buy it. This was videotaped. It was on KSTP last night, and it's available on the Internet. So we're looking for any help that you're willing to give us. The tools in Senator Higgins' bill, the wording of the bill gives us the tools to help us investigate these crimes more successfully. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions? That's right. Right. I believe we have some people who want to speak in opposition to the bill. Are they here? Do you have some other people to speak today, Senator Higgins? All right.
Sure, they're here. No, I think we're good.
Would you like them to come to the table?
Why don't you just come in 1 minute?
1 minute.
Absolutely. We would like, please sit down. And
less than 1 minute. The Minnesota Sheriff's Association and my co-partner, Minnesota Police Chiefs Association, is a statewide issue from border to border. We support it. End of testimony.
We have heard a lot from our urban centers. Can you give us an idea of what's happening in the suburban areas, probably with new construction? Is that an issue? I know we heard a little bit about that. Do you have any sort of records in that sense? Because in my community, obviously, there's a lot of new construction.
For what little construction is going on in greater Minnesota, it is a problem no matter where you go. Again, you've already heard testimony with regard to what happens in the construction sites. That's evident all over the state. We hear the same thing. The other piece that you haven't heard anything about, and that's simply this, and that's the prosecution of the cases. When you prosecute these cases, it's very difficult because, again, the evidence has been altered. It's been taken from a home. How do you prove that that particular piece of copper came from that particular house? Remember, these people, whoever they are innocent until proven guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. And so evidentiary purposes become very difficult in some of these cases. Again, anything that we can do to tighten that down by having them there, matching up evidentiary is important. So it is a very big, important, crucial step forward.
And please speak for the record on into the mic.
Thank you. Madam Chair, my name is Harlan Johnson, the Executive Director for the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association, and we represent chiefs throughout the state. And I have personal knowledge that not so much the suburban areas, but in rural Minnesota, the same thing is happening. I have an interest in property in northern Minnesota. We had a neighboring house, the same thing, where the homeowner died and the home was left vacant until his children could return back from another state to reclaim the property for their parents. And before the children were able to return, the house was stripped, not only just the copper wire, but the copper tubing, but they also went on and took the kitchen sink and all the other utilities that were in there, too. The house was destroyed at the result of that.
Senator Chair. Are there any questions, Senator Tomasoni?
You know, I'm not an attorney, so I'm just listening to you guys, and I'm trying to figure out if we actually do this at the scrapyard level, will you actually be able to match up the copper tubing with the house it came from and be able to actually make a case? I'm trying to figure out how, if we're actually going to be accomplishing anything or not. And I don't know.
In some cases, the answer to that would be yes. In some cases, the answer to that is no. Obviously, we have to know the location where they come from. When you've got copper tubing cut in 2-foot increments, you have no idea. But if you know where the suspect has been that particular night, or if you have an idea, if you can link that back in any way, shape, or form to the neighborhood he's from or any of that, and the fact that his name appears on the record, and you had a theft in that neighborhood, you might get lucky and be able to take a chunked piece and go back and match it through the lab and all the rest of it. It's a tedious, terrible, difficult task. But, again, going back and identifying the person as being the seller is a big step forward in the identification of the individual.
And, Madam Chair,
yes,
Senator Tomasoni, I think one of the most important parts of this bill would be that it's going to dry up the funding source. It's going to dry, you know, it's going to make it so that they can't find a place to go sell the copper and get some money. So so maybe, you know, it will stop the, you know, stop the practice, we hope.
Madam Chair. And Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Higgins or Mr. Franklin, or Sheriff Franklin. What's your relationship with the surrounding states as far as drying up the source? Can't they just take it over to the Wisconsin board?
Madam Chair and Senator, I think this is very much similar to the precursor bill for methamphetamine. We're addressing a problem here in this particular state, but it is also a problem in all of the other states across. We are asking, hoping, encouraging those that would have similar laws to do exactly what we're doing. You are correct, the border issues, especially Fargo-Moorhead, Winona, I mean, those border locations are going to be potential markets where that is going to be taken across the property line. What you now have, however, is an individual that now has a transportation problem. So if he stole the vehicle from whatever that location is, there's a greater degree of probability, factoring in the number of miles traveled, that he would get caught with that vehicle or arrested, or it's going to create another barrier to that disposal. But you are absolutely right. We are encouraging other states to also address this same issue. It is, fortunately or unfortunately, occurring in other states also.
And, Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, a lot of other states are enacting similar legislation to try to dry up the source of the funding as well. I got an email from Hawaii the other day. They're working on the same issue.
Thank you. It is 2:45, and Mr. Cassidy, we're going to let you wait until our next meeting. But if we might encourage, this is obviously a problem. We've heard, you know, about this today, and we would encourage all the stakeholder groups to perhaps talk to each other and see if there's some other suggestions. So that I think that, you know, committee members today have expressed concern over this. We're very concerned about the public safety aspect of this. But who should bear the burden of the compliance? And I think that if the scrap metal owners. I know that when you came to talk to me, I asked, so what is your solution? And if you can work with Senator Higgins, we would certainly like to hear any proposals as well. And Senator Higgins, thank you for bringing this problem forward, because it certainly is impacting people across Minnesota, both as homeowners, property owners, and in a public safety sense. So with that, meeting adjourned.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
It was so hard.